Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Why December the 29th serves to remind us of our call to be daring in our faith as Christians. And Father Jim Brand reflects on how God wants all those who feel lonely, isolated, not allowed to live, to break out and join the party. Marking the feast day of St. Thomas Becket, the 29th of December serves to remind us of our call to be daring in our faith as Christians. But who was this man, the English Catholic Archbishop of Canterbury, who died trying to defend and uphold the truth of the Church? Listen now as Jill Bevilacqua brings us his story.
On a dark December afternoon, four knights of the court of Henry II rode into Canterbury in search of the Archbishop, Thomas Becket. They left him dead in the blackness of his own cathedral, and the common people came to dip their hands in his blood. Within hours, miracles were performed in his name, and 2 years later, he was proclaimed a saint and martyr of the Church.
The quarrel between Thomas of Canterbury and his king is one of the most famous in English history, due mainly to the powerful personalities of the two men, who from being bosom friends became arch enemies, to the point that Henry wished Thomas dead, a wish uttered in anger and deeply regretted when it was granted.
Thomas Becket was born in London in 1118, son of a Norman merchant. As a young man, he worked in the household of Theobald, Archbishop of Canterbury, accompanying him to important European centres and taking time off to study canon law. He held several ecclesiastical posts, and then, in 1154, was appointed Archdeacon of Canterbury.
Thomas has been described by contemporaries as tall and spare, with dark hair and a pale face that flushed in excitement. Henry was obviously impressed by him, for he made him Chancellor of England in the following year. The two men understood each other so well, they were said to be of one heart and mind. So that when Archbishop Theobald died in 1161, Henry saw it as a golden opportunity to subjugate church to state by putting his own man in office.
But he had not reckoned on his friend's reaction. Thomas must have foreseen the dilemmas such an appointment would produce, for he waited a year before accepting the post. And when he did, from being, in his own words, a proud, vain man, a feeder of birds and follower of hounds, he was transformed into a shepherd of sheep.
He opposed the encroachments of the king on the liberties of the clergy and the rights of the church. When Henry ordered him to appear before the great council to explain himself, Thomas refused, denying the authority of the king and placing himself under the protection of the Pope and of God. He fled to France and stayed in exile for 6 years.
Then, in 1170, the king and Becket met in Fretteval, Touraine, and there was a public reconciliation, or so it seemed. Both men, in principle at least, put their claims on one side. The king, for his part, made no mention of his rights and customs. What was more, he guaranteed the archbishop a safe return home and full possession of his see, without demanding any oath of loyalty.
Henry and Thomas met once more later in the year, this time at Chaumont. they would not meet again. Thomas must have had a presentiment, for when they said farewell, he turned to the king with these words.
My lord, my heart tells me that I part from you as one whom you shall see no more in this life.
Do you hold me as a traitor?
That be far from thee, my lord. Adieu.
Adieu, Thomas. Thomas.
And so, to England. Whether to peace or destruction, I know not. God has decreed what fate awaits me.
Thomas was gone, galloping towards his destiny on the other side of the channel. He was not fooled by the king's acquiescent manner. The sooner he was back in Canterbury, the better. Once there, he would appeal to the Pope for unlimited powers of excommunication. That way, he could discipline his ecclesiastical forces. The more potent and fierce the prince is, he wrote, the stronger stick and harder chain is needed to bind him and keep him in order.
The Archbishop was given an ecstatic welcome home. In London, he rode through the streets in triumph, scattering alms to the cheering crowds. In Canterbury, he was received by his monks as an angel of God. But when he preached in the cathedral, he spoke strange words. I am come to die among you. In this church, there are martyrs, and God will soon increase their number.
We do not think of a martyr simply as a good Christian who has been killed because he is a Christian. For that would be solely to mourn. We do not think of him simply as a good Christian who has been elevated to the company of the saints. For that would be simply to rejoice. And neither our mourning nor our rejoicing is as the world's. A Christian martyrdom is never an accident, for saints are not made by accident. Still less is a Christian martyrdom the effect of a man's will to become a saint. As a man, by willing and contriving, may become a ruler of men. A martyrdom is always the design of God, for his love of men, to warn them and to lead them, to bring them back to his way. It is never the design of man. For the true martyr is he who has become the instrument of God, who has lost his will in the will of God, and who no longer desires anything for himself, not even the glory of being a martyr.
But in Becket's absence, the king had seen fit to have his young son crowned by the Archbishop of York. Becket was deeply offended and promptly excommunicated all the clergy who had taken part in the ceremony. They travelled en masse to the king, who was in Normandy, and declared that the Archbishop was ready to tear the crown from the young king's head. This sent Henry into a fury, and surrounded by his knights and nobles, he made the celebrated declaration.
What a pack of fools and cowards I have nourished in my house, but not one of them will avenge me of this turbulent priest.
The king's outburst had its effect immediately. The challenge was taken up. Four knights looked at each other and came to a quick decision. There was no time to lose. They left the court in secret and travelled hotfoot to the coast. Once across the channel, they called for horses and rode fast to Canterbury.
It was the time for Vespers. Thomas the Archbishop followed the monk carrying his crozier through the cloister, slowly, as in processional. He heard the chanting of the monks come from the choir. The storm had come into the cloister. Rain slanted in. A wind scooped down beneath the eaves and wet their faces and blew their garments wildly in the dark. The chanting faded and then rose again. Voices behind them and the splintering of wood. The church was dark. Only the altar lights glowed in the choir, far away. Thomas crossed the transept and started up the steps to the altar. Then, suddenly, behind him, he heard heavy running, and turning, he saw them, and the glint of their mail. The clerks had fled. The monks had left their service. And there was silence in the wavering dark. Thomas came back down the steps towards them, and facing them, he put his back against the pillar and stood still. They closed in towards him, groping in the dark. One of them took his sword in hand and crossed the nave towards the south transept to keep the people back. The three came on. And Thomas saw the bulk of shoulders in the dark, a glimmer on the mail, the pointed helmets and the blur of white, their faces cloven by the nasal guards. They came on crouching, arms held wide. Then the first sprang at him, clutching the pallium round his neck, while another reached for his body to lift him off his feet. A sword swung, arched and whistled in the darkness, grazing Thomas's head, knocking his cap off, leaving the tonsure bare. A shout and another sword descended, glanced along the crozier, and Thomas stood wounded, blood on his face. This was his moment. He had chosen it, not Henry. And he died for God alone, no other way. He crossed his hands and bowed his wounded head. Two more blows and Thomas was on his knees, and a third struck him as he fell, so savage that the iron sword broke off against the stones. The men stood back, panting, as their leader looked down at the body and nudged it with his foot. He put his heel upon the neck and thrust his sword point into the broken skull. And swaggering, he walked away.
When the monks lifted up the corpse, they cried out, for underneath it, now revealed where it had been hidden by the fur-lined robe, there lay the broken blade, all blood-stained, of a sword. They lifted the body and went up the steps to the choir, leaving the broken sword, the costly fur-lined cloak, the folded pallium, behind them on the bloody stones. They brought candles and placed him before the altar. Then their voices rose in lamentation for the dead, in praise of this new martyr of the church.
Henry was shattered by Thomas's death. He swore on the Gospels he had not desired it. He made a solemn oath of perpetual obedience to Rome. He made pilgrimages to Thomas's shrine and did public penance. And Becket's sacrifice was not in vain. Until the Reformation, the church retained the system of ecclesiastical courts independent of the royal authority, and the right of appeal to Rome, two of the major points upon which Becket had defied the king.
But the enigma of Thomas Becket remains. What exactly happened to him when he became Archbishop of Canterbury? Was it simply a question of higher loyalties? Or did he experience something akin to an evangelical conversion, recognizing no master but God? The centuries have not clarified matters, and probably we shall never know.
You've been listening to a program written and produced by Jill Bevilacqua. And now Father Jim Brand, spiritual director of the Pontifical Beda College, recites a beautiful poem by Alfred Lord Tennyson and reflects on how God does not want us to live in isolation.
Hello again, it's Father Jim. As the Lord wants to approach us and be born in us again in a deeper way at Christmas, to make his home in our hearts, I'm thinking of a fortress like Windsor Castle. Quite often visitors come from America and all over the world and they want to see Windsor Castle. And outside Windsor Castle there's this big wall with a portcullis gate. And occasionally the castle is closed. Oh, say, we've come all the way from Chicago. And the portcullis is down. We can't even get into the outer part of the castle. Of course, the thing about a portcullis is these sort of barred gates that goes up. It can either keep you out, or when you enter, it could come down behind you and keep you in. So you can't go freely in and out. It's rather like a praying mantis. If you get close to a praying mantis, you're caught. But sometimes the portcullis is open and the outer bailey of the castle is available. And then inside you've got the state apartments. St. George's Chapel, the Waterloo Chamber, the Queen's Picture Gallery. This is where the Queen will operate officially. And maybe there's some days when people can visit that part, where the Queen is being formal and on duty. But further into the castle, there are the private apartments, where only some famous people who might be guests of the Queen are allowed to stay. That's the more intimate part. I know somebody climbed up a drainpipe at Buckingham Palace and disturbed the Queen in her bedroom once. She offered him a cigarette and then pressed a button for cigarettes, and the butler came in. But normally, most of us don't have access to the intimate part of the castle. And then there's a round tower with thick, thick walls. And I suppose in days if the castle was being attacked, you would have gone into this fortress tower and had hot oil, boiling oil on the roof to tip up on the people who were trying to get through the 12-foot walls. Now, supposing I'm Windsor Castle, how close to me is the Lord allowed to come? Is he still outside in Windsor High Street? Is the portcullis shut? Do I just let him into my formal apartments when I'm being holy or religious? Do I allow him into the intimate part of my life so that he can make his home and put his feet on the mantelpiece and smoke his pipe if he wants, run around with sloppy slippers to be at home? I mean, he said, make your home in me as I make mine in you. And you and I have been created to make a home for him. Or have I retired to this great big fort, this tower, sort of desperation, anything to keep him away from me? I've always been moved by a beautiful poem called The Lady of Shalott. It's a very sad poem. There's a lady who, for some reason or other, has been banished into her fortress. She's not allowed to join the rest of the world. She can only look out, back to front, through a mirror. She sees the world go by, eventually gets fed up. Now, some people are in a sort of prison. They feel they're not allowed to join the world. They're isolated, either through fear or because someone has banished them. They'd love to join the world. But this poor lady has been cursed. She's told, if you do want to join the world and you look, you'll die. It's a terrible, terrible sentence that somebody has given her. She's been told, you're not allowed to live. Our Lord wants to be allowed inside these fortresses we build for ourselves and to lead us out so that we can join the merry world and not just survive, but live life to the full. So I'm going to share this poem with you. I think it's a great parable about where some people feel they are. The Lady of Shalott. On either side the river lie long fields of barley and of rye that clothe the wold and meet the sky, and through the field the road runs by to many-towered Camelot. And up and down the people go, gazing where the lilies blow round an island there below, the island of Shalott. Willows whiten, aspens quiver, little breezes dusk and shiver through the wave that runs forever by the island in the river flowing down to Camelot. Four grey walls and four grey towers overlook a space of flowers, and the silent isle embowers the Lady of Shalott. By the margin, willow-veiled, slide the heavy barges, trailed by slow horses, and unhailed the shallop flitteth silken-sailed, skimming down to Camelot. But who's seen her wave her hand? Or at the casement seen her stand? Or is she known in all the land, the Lady of Shalott? Only reapers reaping early in among the bearded barley hear a song that echoes cheerly from the river winding clearly down to towered Camelot. And by the moon, the reaper, weary, piling sheaves in uplands airy, listening, whispers, 'Tis the fairy Lady of Shalott. There she weaves by night and day a magic web with colours gay. She's heard a whisper say a curse is on her if she stay to look down to Camelot. She knows not what the curse may be, and so she weaveth steadily, and little other care hath she, the Lady of Shalott. And moving through a mirror clear that hangs before her all the year, shadows of the world appear. There she sees the highway near, winding down to Camelot. There the river eddy whirls, and there the surly village churls and the red cloaks of the market girls pass onward from Shalott. Sometimes a troop of damsels glad, an abbot on an ambling pad. Sometimes a curly shepherd lad or long-haired page in crimson clad goes by to towered Camelot. And sometimes through the mirror blue the knights come riding two by two. She hath no loyal knight and true, the Lady of Shalott. But in her web she still delights to weave the mirror's magic sights, for often through the silent nights a funeral with plumes and lights and music went to Camelot. When the moon was overhead came two young lovers lately wed. "I'm half sick of shadows," said the Lady of Shalott. A bowshot from her bower eaves, he rode between the barley sheaves. The sun came dazzling through the leaves and flamed upon the brazen greaves of bold Sir Lancelot. A red cross knight forever kneeled to a lady in his shield that sparkled on the yellow field beside remote Shalott. The gemmy bridle glittered free like to some branch of stars we see hung in the golden galaxy. The bridal bells rang merrily as he rode down to Camelot, and from his blazoned baldric slung a mighty silver bugle hung, and as he rode his armour rung beside remote Shalott. All in the blue unclouded weather, thick jewels shone the saddle leather, the helmet and the helmet feather burned like one burning flame together as he rode down to Camelot. As often through the purple night, below the starry clusters bright, some bearded meteor, trailing light, moves over still Shalott. His broad, clear brow in sunlight glowed. On burnished hooves his warhorse trod, from underneath his helmet flowed his coal-black curls, as on he rode, as he rode down to Camelot. And from the bank, and from the river, he flashed into the crystal mirror. Tirralirra! By the river sang Sir Lancelot.
She left the web, she left the loom, she made three paces through the room. She saw the water lily bloom. She saw the helmet and the plume. She looked down to Camelot. Out flew the web and floated wide. The mirror cracked from side to side. "The curse is come upon me," cried the Lady of Shalott. In the stormy east wind straining, the pale yellow woods were waning, the broad stream in its banks complaining. Heavily the low sky raining over towered Camelot. Down she came and found a boat neath the river left afloat, and round about the prow she wrote, "The Lady of Shalott." And down the river's dim expanse, like some bold seer in a trance, seeing all his own mischance, with a glassy countenance did she look to Camelot. And at the closing of the day she loosed the chain, and down she lay. The broad stream bore her far away, the Lady of Shalott, lying robed in snowy white that loosely flew to left and right, the leaves upon her falling light through the noises of the night. She floated down to Camelot. And as the boat head wound among the willowy hills and fields among, they heard her singing her last song, the Lady of Shalott. Heard a carol, mournful, lowly, chanted loudly, chanted slowly, till her blood was frozen slowly, and her eyes were darkened, wholly turned to towered Camelot. For ere she reached upon the tide the first house by the waterside, singing in her song, she died, the Lady of Shalott. Under tower and balcony, by garden wall and gallery, a gleaming shape, she floated by, dead pale, between the houses high, silent into Camelot. Out upon the wharves they came, knight and burgher, lord and dame, and round the prow they read her name, the Lady of Shalott. Who is this? And what is here? And in the lighted palace near died the sound of royal cheer, and they crossed themselves for fear, all the knights of Camelot. But Lancelot mused a little space. He said, "She has a lovely face. Oh, God in his mercy lent her grace, the Lady of Shalott." Too late! Too late! Oh, that somebody had never cursed her. Oh, that someone had undone the dreadful curse. Oh, that someone had managed to get into her little closet and released her from this curse and brought her out. That is what the Lord wants to do. For all peoples who feel lonely, isolated, not allowed to live, he wants to bring them out to join the party. Amen.
Laudetur Jesus Christus.